Hey, it's Dan Patrick. Here's your chance to score with Maaco Auto Body Shop. Join us in San Francisco for Super Week. That's right, a trip for two, airfare, hotel stay, and VIP access to see us do our show. Maaco also giving away 5 free paint jobs and 10 swag bags. Enter daily for a chance to win. Get official rules at danpatrick.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Open to contiguous U.S. D.C. residents 18 or over. Ends 11/23/25.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Hello and welcome to a bonus edition of the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. You might have heard of her. She was Washington correspondent for New York Magazine for a while, and she has a new book out today titled American Canto. It's Olivia Nuzzi. How you doing, girl?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I didn't have to publish a newsletter today where I discussed all the ways my book rollout was going awry, highlighting the fact that Monica Lewinsky keeps checking in on me. So I don't know.
She's so nice. She's incredibly kind. But yeah, that's a good indicator that the public, it's sort of the Lewinsky scale of kindness. It's like the Richter scale for public shaming, I think. So yeah, that if your agent tells you I love you, doesn't explain why they're texting you that.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a victory text. Has Monica offered any particular nuggets of wisdom from her experience?
I don't want to violate her any more than the country has done for so long, but she's been really, really, really kind, and I'm very appreciative.
In some ways, she benefited from being pre-internet, really. A little bit of a different animal.
Well, but it was sort of the first internet-based shaming, right? When you think about it. Probably, I think. I wasn't cognizant at the time, but...
Yeah, that's true. I guess it was Drudge. It's a little different than the minute by minute, the second by second, blow by blow that you're into.
Yeah.
I want to start saying to you when we decide to do this, I just kind of want to like pretend like I just bumped into you at a hotel and ask like all the burning questions I have about how this came to pass, because we haven't like talked all that much. I've been a little bit from time to time texting over the past year. And I think my first question would just be like, why did you decide to do this, right? Like, why did you write this? You could have just, I don't know. I mean, you did kind of disappear for a year. You could have wrote under a nom de plume, could have done anything. You decided to do this. What was the, why did you do it?
Well, I was writing, right? I'm always writing. Like, I remember when my dad died, I came home and that night I sat there and I wrote his obituary. And like, for me, I think it's just a way of establishing sort of, the contours of reality, you know, to get down everything that can be stated for certain and have a better idea that way of what cannot be stated for certain. And so I guess it's just what I'm always doing. And then what I was writing started to take on this kind of shape, and I had a sense of what I thought maybe it was becoming or revealing. And I sent some of it to my editor, Jofi at Avid Reader Press, and he just responded, "I get it." And that was sort of all I needed to hear. And I'm not much of a planner, if you can believe it. And there was no like sitting down like, oh, what do I do, right? There were a lot of people telling me, oh, just keep going, right? Cover the end of the election, take some other assignment, like be shameless, because everyone else involved is shameless and you should be shameless too. But I think shame is really important. And I had fucked up, right? I did something wrong. Like, those ethics rules exist for a reason. They're really good rules. And I had violated that. And it struck me that, like, it's not like you just wake up one day and you make a big mistake, right? It had to have been many imperceptible errors that like contributed to really just a malformed perspective that led to that type of mistake. And I took it really seriously, you know, and I thought it was like this big, important spiritual event in my life that I didn't want to just pretend that it didn't happen. I didn't, at first it's like an intoxicating thought, you know, like, oh, could I just do that? And then immediately it's just, no, of course I can't do that and live it myself. And so I just sort of wrote and thought and tried to like stay out of trouble and stay out of
I don't know if you achieved that part.
But I did. But that's the thing. It's like I don't want to allow someone else's chaos that they're stirring up to be put on me. You know, I did, right? I wrote this book. It's about America. It's about ideas. It's about the last 10 years in America and reality distorting. What other people are talking about opportunistically in this discourse is not what this book is about. And so that's someone else's trouble.
I mean, there's so much there. I have like 18 follow-up questions, so we'll just kind of take them one at a time. I think you're kind of pitching it's Letters to a Young Poet. It's Rilke, where he says, I write because I must. Like there's that kind of element. I write, that's just because that's what I do. I write.
I'm pitching it. Yeah, yeah. Not pitching.
And there's
case.
Kind of reasoning for doing this, which like makes sense. In the book, you write about the editor that you had told you that you should try to write your way out of
at New York Magazine.
Your problem. Write your way
at New York Magazine. That was presented to me as sort of a way to keep my job, right. Rather than what happened. That if I wrote some sort of tell-all, yeah.
Yeah, but this doesn't really feel like that, right? And this, mm-hmm. like, in some ways, you tell some stuff about RFK, which we'll get into, and you tell some stuff about your life and you reflect, but it doesn't feel like you were trying to write your way out of trouble.
No, I mean, I wrote myself further into it, right? Because I revealed things that people didn't even know I did wrong, but that it felt to me like important if I was going to write a book like this. I wanted people to, I guess, know what they were dealing with, or I didn't see any value in trying to like spin it in some way to make me look good. There was no me looking good in that situation, right? And I think I'm always trying to just talk to the smartest person in the room, right? Talk to the person reading who is, to me, smartest means the most open-minded, right? The most interested in or capable of holding nuance, the most curious. And I knew that there would be like a tabloid cannibalization and a media like navel gazing interpretation, and that all of that would probably be, you know, like it typically is. But I was just writing the book that I felt I had a responsibility to write creatively and spiritually and like with my time here. And I took really seriously, I got very upset at a certain point when they sent the books to print. It occurred to me just how serious it is to kill so many trees to print your book. And I got very upset. And every time I would ask Simon and Schuster about, well, how many trees exactly is that? They would send me this propaganda back about how many trees Simon and Schuster plants every year. And I was like, well, I didn't ask how many you planted. I asked how many you killed. But I didn't want to waste anybody's time or waste any trees. And I took that really seriously. And like, it's not an effort to like brand myself in any particular way, you know?
I went back and rewatched. You interviewed me after I wrote my book, which was a big kind of reflection on like my failings.
I love that book.
Thank you. Yeah. And I rewatched the interview just to kind of see what we talked about, like refresh my memory. And you were kind of struck by how bleak I was, like, and about the state of affairs, like bleak about, you know, politics, about Washington, like kind of bleak about myself. And your book wasn't really that bleak, Like, really? I mean, like, there are bleak parts, you know, but like, you really try, it feels like, to you know, talk about what you got out of this. And like, you talk about God and spirituality way more than I remember you talking about it. Maybe you just don't talk about it with me because I'm a heathen gay. I don't know. But I, like, I don't know. I guess my question is, going through this whole like terribleness, you've now mentioned spirituality twice in this podcast. Like, do you feel like you've found something?
Yeah, I'm going to rebrand to like be a trad wife or something. Well,
I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of God. You're capitalizing God in the book.
You'll catch me in at CPAC. No, yeah. I mean, I never had really written anything personal before. You know, the work was always subjective, right? Because that type of work is subjective. But it was rarely personal. Like, occasionally I would write in, like, something would happen, right? My mom happened to die when I was with Jill Biden at a hospital, not the right hospital. And, you know, I worked that into the piece. There's a little bit there. But typically when I always thought that if I was really in a piece, it was a process failure. And I guess this has been the ultimate process failure. Yeah. And so I'm in the book a lot, right? But I had never really, you know, written about those things. And I guess I'm trying to think of how to explain it. I guess I felt like with the rapturous events of last year and with the big crash out, there was an enormous opportunity before me that I shouldn't waste. And that opportunity was about figuring out what I had done wrong and how it had come to be that I had made this mistake, and assessing what had gone wrong, and taking it seriously. And if I did that right, and if I like made it through this dishonor in an honorable way, if I didn't try to use anyone as a human shield, you know, if I didn't try to say, oh, you know, it wasn't so bad, or it wasn't a big deal, or then hopefully I'd be able to proceed better than I was living before, and that had led me to failure, right? And so I guess that's where that comes from.
Like, how hard did you find it to do that, to insert yourself into this and to write about yourself? And when you, I'm struck, like, look, I guess maybe not every single person, but many of us, myself included, loved your like political profiles. And there's always this kind of irreverence to them and kind of a wry, dispassionate assessment of the silliness and the veepishness of it all.
Veepishness.
And yeah, right. And that's hard to do when you're like looking at yourself and assessing your own mistakes, and you want to take that seriously. And I'm wondering, as you've seen some of the reviews of the book and stuff, like, some people's criticism is that that's kind of hard to bridge, right? That if you're going to look at everybody else kind of like a mocking, irreverent lens, and then look at yourself very seriously, like, it's hard to bridge those two. Did you struggle with that?
I don't think I'm looking at, well, I think I mock myself rather a lot, right? I mean, I published a list today, a day of publication of my book, about everything that's gone wrong with publication of this book, right? But I don't think that I look at people in the way that you describe. I mean,
maybe mocking was probably unfair, but irreverent. Like, there's a puckishness to it. There's a puckishness to your writing about other people, you know?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I don't know. I don't, that kind of sounds like not my business if people feel that way about the book. You know, I wasn't really trying to do anything in this book other than write something honest, and be honest about my experiences and how it felt and, what had happened and how I was kind of putting it in context. And I didn't see a way around it, right? Like, it's the necessary context from my perspective this last year, and from the perspective and the vantage point from which I was writing this book was on the periphery, pretty far from the story I've been covering geographically and in every other way. And it was that perspective that allowed me to complete this thought that I had begun forming when I first started writing about Donald Trump 10 years earlier. And it was also that perspective that allowed me, I felt like, I don't know if you felt like this, but I felt like I was covering this world and associating with people in this world for a really long time. And I had just ceased to be able to see it clearly in some ways. Like I just was too, it was too familiar. And I write about that, about how something can become, you know, so familiar that it's foreign. And it really wasn't until I fled and, you know, ended up on the wrong side of the country at the end of the election, that I felt like I could get a hold of it.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously felt that way. And I don't know, like one way out of it for me was I just decided that like the only way to deal with like all of the like bullshitting and all of the unreality of this kind of world that Donald Trump has created was to just be like completely myself and just be totally radically candid about what I think about it and fuck it, mm-hmm. like whatever, and the world be damned. And that, it's kind of hard to do that as a journalist. I'm not a mm-hmm. journalist, right? So it's we had a different challenge and I felt like that was freeing for me. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, for you, as you kind of looked at this process, like whether like you felt like you were able to do that, like you were either able to like be.
Well, it sounds like you think I wasn't.
Well,
it's okay.
I guess here's what I'd say. I don't know if you were, if you weren't, I guess would be my answer to the question, because I think that like the mm-hmm. way that the book is written, there are parts of it that are like so beautiful and elegant and interesting, and they are, you know, it piques curiosity in various ways. You know, you write it so like the politicians don't have names, you know, at times like you write about the politician and the MAGA general and stuff. And so there is this element to it that's still a little like mysterious, mm-hmm. right? And there are parts where you're like, I mean, just unbelievably vulnerable, like talking about your parents' death and talking about RFK. Mm-hmm. But yet, like at the end of it, I still kind of felt like, I don't know what she really thinks about all of this that has happened that she's covered for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's trying to tell me and I just can't, I can't quite grasp it.
I think, you know, there's that cliche to show and not tell when you write. Yeah. And I have always tried to abide by that. And I felt here, I mean, I think that my worldview is reflected in all manner of ways that I write about, you know, immigration, the border, or that I write about January 6th. I mean, so much of the book really comes back to January 6th. I don't think it's like a mystery. And I think the details that I include and the kind of that form this portraiture of the characters that you refer to, I think however you feel about it as a reader at the end is correct. You know, I can't tell you how to feel, and I wouldn't, but I can tell you what I experienced and what I saw and what I heard and what it felt like, you know?
Yeah. And I guess that is what I was sort of trying to get back to with the question about Rilke's kind of writing because you must versus like trying to write out of this, right? Because mm-hmm. that was a choice, right? Like you could write a book that had these various pastiches and that you know, kind of expressed how you felt about the moments mm-hmm. and leave people still a little bit, you know, the mystery that comes with that kind of writing, right? Like, or you could have ripped the Band-Aid off and said, no, and done a real tell-all, right? You could have ripped the Band-Aid off and said, no, this is what really happened. This is what I think about Bobby.
I did rip the Band-Aid off emotionally, right? I didn't think that there was any real value in sharing my opinions about things, right? But my assessments and my descriptions and my the way that I reveal character, I do think is valuable, right? That's the sort of privilege afforded to people who cover this sort of stuff in general, or the kind of cursed privilege, I suppose, of having been as stupid as I was and getting mired in a situation which my vantage point was different than it should have been, right? Is that I have a perspective informed in ways that other people could not possibly be informed, and I have a responsibility to share about that. I thought there was value in that. I didn't think that there was value for anything other than the immediate discourse, right? The 24-hour discourse in making big judgments. I think that the details I include and the portraits that I paint are the judgment, you know?
Right, guys, I'm not a big wallet purchaser. I've probably had, I don't know, 3 wallets my entire adult life. And I had a little while where I had a Costanza wallet going. Then I decided to keep nothing in my wallet. I've been all over the map. And when we got this new sponsor, Ridge, I have to admit, I'm just going to admit right off, I was a little skeptical. It's a little different than my other wallets. It's sleek. It's has a little bit of heft to it. It's a little more masculine than I self-identify. As it turns out, my skepticism was unwarranted. And now you can join me and you can say hello to Ridge 2.0, the most refined version of the Ridge wallet. Everything's better on 2.0. It's 10% lighter. They found the perfect balance between, you know, sturdiness and it's in like the boxing category. It's like a featherweight. Strong and sturdy, but also featherish. They made it more modular with improved catch straps, money clips, and the AirTag attachment in case you're a loser. I'm also a loser of things. So you can ensure that you're going to find your wallet if you, you know, leave it on the table at the bar, for one example. That definitely didn't happen to me. It's got over 50 colors and styles to choose from. You can even get a wallet that features every NFL, MLB, or college team. You know, we can now wear our Tigers stuff proudly now that Brian Kelly's gone and we got Lane Kiffin. Plus, all Ridge wallets have a new industry-leading built-for-life warranty. So, for a limited time, Ridge is having their huge holiday sale. Head to RIDGE.com to get up to 47% off your order. This is by far the biggest discount they've given all year. That's Ridge.com for up to 47% off your order during their biggest sale of the year. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. I think that what some folks would say, particularly with from like the journalism lens, the questions would be like, not like, oh, I'm looking for Olivia Nuzzi's punditry on every single thing that HHS has done, right? But more like, mm-hmm. Do we exactly know like the extent of what happened, right? Like one of the stories that's come up, for example, that's in the book, you write about when, I forget what magazine, it was either New York or New York Magazine, was going to write about the bear story where Bobby had taken a bear off the side of the road and left it in Central Park, I guess. And you said that you had like kind
as
of
you do.
Yeah, as you do, right? I had a lot of follow-up questions about that, like when he washed his hands and stuff, but like that's kind of for another podcast. But because he says he gets on a plane after, and I'm like, but poor person sitting next to him. But like you talk about how you kind of like figured out for him that like that story was going to run, and you talked to him about it and then gave him some advice on how to handle it, then he didn't take the advice. Mm-hmm. And like that all was happening like when you're still covering the campaign, right? And so like that question of like, mm-hmm. you know, for people, and you're talking about telling, like how much were you giving him advice on how to, you know, were you helping him?
I write about that in the book about, you know, when he would ask my opinion or ask for advice, my approach was Socratic mostly, right? And I would just help him talk it out. And that anytime I gave prescriptive advice, he never took it, right? But I didn't view my role as telling him what to do. Like I, as unbelievable as it is, I loved him, right? And I cared about him. And I didn't, you know, I didn't think that, I just didn't think it was my place to tell him what to do. And I wouldn't have wanted to tell him what to do anyhow. But I think I was just operating under this delusion that because he was so on the periphery, right? Because what he was doing seemed so irrelevant. And his polling was so low and it was getting lower, right? In the time from when I had written about him, I think the polling went from like a one-off 20% poll down to like 3% on average. So it didn't feel like, you know, the one time it came up at New York Magazine as, you know, someone was working on something and how was I, you know, could I help them? Like I sent them to the campaign. I also sent them to the DNC, to Liz Smith, right, who was running the campaign against him. You know, I gave insight that was not helpful at all. And it, you know, on balance affected it, neutrally or negatively, but it didn't come up really otherwise, because nobody really cared that, other than when it would, you know, reach the level of meme that he was running. And so I think I was able to kind of keep this diluted perspective that it was like just this private thing that was so irrelevant that it wasn't going to pose any sort of problem. And then lo and behold, it unfurled in this way where it just directly collided with the main event that I was covering, right?
And I think that's like, again, where, now this is long after you profiled him, but you're still, as you say, you're covering the race. Mm-hmm. Like, you get to the point you talk about in the book where he's like deciding who to endorse. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, you're talking back and forth about this. And I think he says it makes him feel nauseous to endorse Biden, nauseous to endorse Trump.
Mm-hmm. But I think when you're in the, you know, it was the sort of revelation of him to me as the person that I would come to think of as the politician. It really starts there, where when you've been in the wilderness for so long, right, when you have been irrelevant and you have not been invited to any inner circle, and you have to fight to be heard, or you're disinvited from things or deplatformed or whatever, when you are suddenly invited in, when you're suddenly being cheered for, it seemed to me that it activated this part of the personality that just, it didn't matter where the cheering was coming from. It just mattered that it felt good to be cheered. And it was astonishing to watch, and it has remained so.
But in some ways, you're like wrapped up in that. And so, right. And there is this, you talk about like the reality distortion field, but like you were writing at some point about how, like, I think you wrote, I was proud of him because he believed the decision was the best means to be of service to others. Like, the decision was going to endorse Trump. And like, you'd covered Trump for 9 years. Like, like, at some level, you had to know that that was not going to be a way for him to serve others by going to work for Donald Trump.
I also wrote about how in helping him talk through the decision, right? I wrote about how, in my view, all of the perils of endorsing Trump, right? All of the perils of trying to work with Trump. That was all the case, obviously. It was also the case that because he has no beliefs, Trump, right? And because he has no principles, and because he really just orients himself around power, around celebrity, it is a malleable situation, or it's porous rather, right? And the best example that I could think of was what Kim Kardashian did with criminal justice reform, right? And so I, in talking it through, you know, that was the sort of like, sure, she stood next to him, right? She risked ridicule and being made a fool of, but she did manage to get a nonviolent offender's prison term commuted. She did manage to help enact the First Step Act. She did manage to at least elevate this conversation at the federal level about something that I think was good. So the idea that there's never an opportunity, I think Trump's lack of any belief system can be, for someone with the correct motivations and who knows what they are doing, can be an opportunity.
But do you think he had the correct motivations?
In that instance, right? But it didn't work out that way. No.
Right.
No, absolutely not. In retrospect, at the time though, like I write, I believed in him and I believed him. And that's not, it's not a positive thing for me to reveal, right? It's just the truth.
Right. So this is the part I'm trying to process. Yeah. So like, you keep thinking the love part. I hate to do this like a high school thing, but I'm like trying to understand it. So like, did you kiss him? Did you kiss him?
I'm not doing this type of thing. Like, well, I write about it in the book, and like, I just not.
Well, I'm just trying to understand. Look, we all.
I didn't
all deal
write
with
that
this.
Type of book, right? I didn't.
And I'm so, not looking for. I don't want to like a list of the like all the anything that you did with Bobby. I'm just trying to understand. Like, you say you loved him.
Mm-hmm.
But like we all I deal with this. Like this is not with somebody that was trying to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, but I can think back mm-hmm. in the day when I was kissing boys and I'd like think that I was in love with somebody mm-hmm. and then you would go and you'd have a night and you'd wake mm-hmm. up the next morning and you're like, this was crazy. I thought I was falling in love with this person. This person's mm-hmm. insane, actually. Like I didn't know what I was talking about. I was infatuated. Mm-hmm. It's like that's what I'm trying to understand. Like looking back on it, like do you feel like you really were in love with him or like you just were infatuated and caught up in it?
I think we were both alone a lot, right? We were both on the road a lot. I was avoiding trying to figure out what I was doing in my personal life. I wasn't happy. I was being a coward about it, right? I think he didn't really have anyone who wasn't working for him that he could talk to about what he was dealing with. And I guess it was kind of formed of that mutual isolation. I get the question that it's like, were my feelings real if he was not real?
Right.
If I, I don't think so.
Yeah. And so that's like the part that I'm trying
to. I'm yeah. writing about these things at the time. So it was important to me, like my perspective is different now. Right. And I know things now that I did not know then. And I just have more information now, but it was important to me to be honest about what I was feeling then and what it felt like then, and to not rewrite that based on my present interpretation of it, right? When I'm writing about those events at that time during that campaign, I'm just writing about what happened and what it felt like. I'm not rendering a judgment about that.
And I'm not either. What I'm trying to get to is I'm trying to tie it into like, you're also writing about what happened after, right? Like after he betrays you, mm-hmm. after he leaks about you, after he ghosts you. Mm-hmm. And at that point, like if you look back on a campaign where at some points you were like giving mm-hmm. him advice and running down information mm-hmm. for him, like was it just he was using you?
Possibly. But I reveal those things, right? Like that's, I guess, maybe we just have different styles. Like that's my way of telling you what I think.
Yeah. We certainly have different styles and that's good because we're supposed to be different. But I'm like mad. I'm madder at him than you are. I'm mad at him. I'm like, fuck you, RFK. Fuck the way you treated Olivia. Mm-hmm. And fuck you what you're doing right now, honestly. And like mm-hmm. when I'm in the book, like you are hard on yourself. You're hard on some mm-hmm. other people. There are more things that I think that you could reveal about him, I would assume, that you've chosen not to. And if he betrayed you, mm-hmm. why not reveal the truth about him?
I think I did. I mean, the fact that you had that reaction tells me that I gave you enough information.
But have you given us enough information that is in the public interest, I guess, is my question, right? Like,
I think so. And
the New York Times asked you if he had texted you, if you had released them, like, shouldn't you just empty the clip is what I'm saying. Like, shouldn't you give people everything that you have so that we're not left to kind of like, wonder.
I think people have taken from me quite a lot over this process, right? It's like, how much more do I have to violate myself? Right. And this book is not about him. And this is my, no, but you are. You are, actually. Right. And I had to weigh what can I tell you and what should I tell you? Right. That is in the public interest, that is not about the immediate discourse. What is important for people to understand about this that is not coming from my fear, from my ego? Right. But that's also responsible. And I talked about what I felt like only I could talk about, right? As it relates to anything else, it's like a complicated question where you get into what's the responsible way to handle information that you might be privy to when your conflict might render it discredited, right?
Sure.
And it's a complicated question, and like one I have a lot to say to you privately, but like, you know.
And he's the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Like, I guess my point is, I'm not trying to take from you. Like, I don't care about your love life with any person in the private or otherwise. And if you want to gossip with me over brunch, I'm happy to do that.
I hate like brunch, in this but case, yeah, we can do that somewhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah, sure. Over dinner, over whatever, happy hour, late night, I'm open. I'm not a big brunch fan anymore either myself. I just like to fit into stereotypes. But like, he's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Like, you kind of allude in the book that he's doing drugs. Like, is he doing drugs?
I mean, I tell you what I felt like if I could tell you responsibly in the book about that, right? I talk about him telling me that he is doing some drugs. I didn't administer any drugs, so I can only tell you so much. But I tell you what I think you should know about that. Like, that's the information that I had about that, right? Him telling me that, this person who says that he's sober, right? And he was telling me privately that in fact he was not sober, and he was hiding it, not just from the public, but from his own wife, among other things. And I write that in the book because I think it was in the public interest to do so.
Right. You mentioned DMT, but like, is he doing other drugs? Is he doing ketamine? Is he doing?
I mean, I think I write in the book that I had asked him about another drug I heard that he was doing, and he had, you know, emphatically denied it. But I can't say that I make much of his emphatic denial of anything.
Sure. You also say at times like you're afraid of him. Were you like actually afraid, like feeling a threat?
What are you referring to?
Well, you were told that his bodyguard, you know, mm-hmm. was a dangerous person, and that mm-hmm. there were, you know, like threats, and like he had a temper, and you know, like when during the key period where after he'd endorsed Trump, where this all comes out, obviously mm-hmm. he's menacing you. He doesn't want you to come public with information. Like that's pretty alarming for somebody that's the Secretary again of Health and Human Services.
I mean, I wrote about my experience as honestly as possible in a way that I thought served the public interest and just would be of use maybe. Right. But it's not for this immediate discourse. And I think that there's like a lot of, there's this enormous appetite for this tell all. Right. And for something that would be satisfying, I guess, to people who want to watch others get torn to shreds. But I didn't have any interest in, I didn't think that was going to be worth anyone's time. And I never would have, I would just never do something like that. Right. Like what I wrote something that is about all of this is relevant insofar as it's the necessary context for a reader, right. About who they're dealing with here as their narrator. Right. I have the responsibility to be honest about that. And it's also factors in to my broader understanding of this 10-year period of Trump's rise to dominance, right? Where reality just seems to be distorting, kind of sprawling out from the center around Trump. And my job was to talk to monstrous people, including Donald Trump, right? And to make sense of them and translate for people who would never or could never do that. And a lot got blurred. And so that experience with him that we're talking about, I think is just an important, it's important context. And it was an important event in my life. And it was important for me to be honest about it in this book. And it factored into this broader story about the distortion of reality.
Holiday season can be pretty stressful. How's it the holiday season already? I don't know. But if you're like me, you're traveling, you're working your ass off. You also have got to, you know, purchase presents, especially if you have kids and you've got to purchase extra presents. We're not going to say why. And so when you need to slow down at night and actually relax, but not have a hangover the next day, you can turn to Soles Out of Office Gummies. It's a perfect balance of CBD and THC that helps me and my husband and other people in my life find calm and peace of mind. Soul's wellness brand that believes feeling good should be fun and easy. They specialize in delicious hemp-derived THC and CBD products designed to boost your mood and help you unwind. Their best-selling out-of-office gummies were designed to prove a mild, relaxing buzz, boost your mood, and enhance creativity and relaxation. And if you like their out-of-office gummies, go to what I actually prefer, which is the out-of-office beverage, a refreshing alcohol-free alternative that's perfect for winding down on the couch or socializing with friends or spacing out for a little while, if that's something that you need in your life. So take advantage of Sol's Black Friday to Cyber Monday deal right now. For a limited time, get 40% off your entire order. Go to GetSol.com and use the code TheBulwark. That's GetSol.com, promo code TheBulwark for 40% off. Don't miss their best deal of the year right now. I want to get to the broader story about the distortion of reality. I just want to make this one more point about RFK, just in hopes that you can maybe provide perspective on this, because I can understand like being in your shoes. I've been in your not your shoes, Lord knows, but
if you want, you can borrow them.
I might, but firestorms, you know, and it becomes, that is reality distorting, right? People are shitting on you, and I think that there are people out there that just want to hear every prurient detail of your life. There are people out there that like want to see you fail. There are people out there that like are mad at you for various things, and I can understand how one might jumble that with like, I think that there are people out there that have that are legitimately enraged about Bobby because he has like, you know, they view his views on vaccine as resulting in childhood deaths. We have, since he's been in there, we've gotten rid of USAID. He's canceled funding for MNRA research. He's purged expert scientists from the government, massive cuts to NIH research. I mean, there are people that look at him and see him as a monster. And so I'm trying to channel the frustration that they might have that you would say, well, I have other information, you know, that I'm not going to do a tell-all about everything about him. It's like, why not?
But I shared everything that I felt I responsibly could share, right? And I also, in this book, right, in this context, I told the most honest story that I could possibly tell. And I don't think it's hard to have this conversation in public. It's like because it's just,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. For instance, the person I write about is the man I did not marry, right?
Can we just say who it is for people? Do you want me just to say it, or should we just leave it like that?
It's your show.
I think we're talking about Ryan. She's referring, for folks who are trying to follow the character, she's referring to Ryan Lissa, who's written about this.
But he has presented his harassment of me, right, in this humiliation campaign as some sort of crusade that's in the public interest, right? That somehow the country will be saved by him writing some combination of like fan fiction and revenge porn, right? Yeah. And he alluded to or claimed that he was in possession of some explosive information somehow from me, unclear, that related to the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. And
sick.
Right. I was just thinking, let's say if that were true, it's not true, by the way, but if that were true, the only responsible way for him to handle that information as a journalist, he would know this, would be to quietly pass it off to an organization that does not have his conflicts, right? Because his conflicts make it so that that information could be readily dismissed, right? Or that it is tainted by the context that that information would appear in, which would be this campaign of vengeance, right? This kind of suicide bomber's manifesto that he's been publishing. That to me tells you all you need to know about whether or not there is serious information in the public interest that he is in possession of that's going to be explosive, right? Because it would not be responsible to reveal it that way, right? And so I think it's tough to talk about because you've got to make different calculations about different types of information. I shared in this book what I thought was mine to share, what related to my experience, what I felt that I could state for certain, And what I felt related to this broader story about the distortion of reality amid Trump's rise and the distortion of my reality, right? And I think it's worth people's time. You know, if people want to talk about their ideas about the book or what their what their ideas about the author or their ideas about what the book should have been instead, that's up to anyone who wants to do that. I'm not going to tell anyone how to think or feel about anything, but that's not, you know, my hope is that the actual book that I wrote will be assessed on its merits.
Yeah. I, just for the record, found what he did by trying to tease for subscriptions the notion that you had some secret information about a conspiracy related to the Butler shooting in order to get Blue and On people to sign up, to be really, really gross.
Among other grotesque things. Yeah.
There have been others, but yeah, that one in particular got my goat. The point though that you make though is why doesn't he hand over information to a neutral reporter? I think that would be a fair question people would ask of you, like particularly not less now about the book, but like during that period between when he, RFK, endorsed Trump and the election. Like in theory, there could have
Well, you have no idea what I did or didn't do, first of all. But in that period, that was at the end of August, right, of 2024. Yeah. By this next month is sort of, I mean, I write about it in the book, but the next month is sort of spent with my world cracking up, right? And then with this scandal breaking out in public, and then with me fearing for my life, my privacy, and fleeing and then ending up out here and spending this year trying to lay low and think and write.
I hear you, Olivia. And I just like, this is just with love, but like the guy ends up getting nominated to be HHS secretary. You've seen up hand how he lies and manipulates people. You've seen it firsthand. You have evidence. He's getting nominated. And you write in the book that like you were praying that God would use him as a force for good. It's like, I mean, by that point, it was pretty obvious that God was not going to use him as a force for good. Was it not?
You still pray.
Well, but there was no indication. It wasn't like I was praying that he was going to use him for force for good, .. parentheses. But I knew he was not because he's a lying son of a bitch who is like perpetrating a fraud on the public. Like that wasn't in there. Wasn't in there. So like, do you see it clear?
We pray differently. Well,
but could you have prayed for good, but also tried to stop it? You could have tried to stop it.
What are you asking me exactly?
He was trashing you. Mm-hmm. He's being nominated to be HHS secretary. Mm-hmm. His reign, I think, as you said in the newsletter today, you agree with, has not been good. You had information that you could have shared. Look, Matt Gaetz got denied. It's possible. RFK wasn't even a Republican. It's possible that these senators could have not, you know, confirmed him, and you didn't share anything about him. Why? Like, why? Did you still love him, or
I don't know how to responsibly handle this on camera with you here. I'm writing in that scene that you're talking about how I felt privately.
Yeah.
About my private reaction, how I felt privately. Right. So,
but you had acted public, you'd acted to help him. Like you admit in the book, you'd acted to help him over the course of the campaign. Mm-hmm. And so like, once you realized that he was screwing you over, you didn't take any counteraction. You just let him, right? Walk over you.
You're reading about it now. I lost my job.
Well, but right? now he's in there and he's doing a lot of bad stuff. Like, don't you look at that and think, like, do you look at that? I guess when you're saying that you have the distance now that have clarity, like, do you see clearly what he's doing now?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's, what was your phrasing? It hasn't been good. I agree with that. I think that's the correct assessment, but I don't really know what to do with the question that you're asking me, because it's making a lot of assumptions.
It's not making assumptions. It's just like you said, you helped him, right, during the campaign.
Mm-hmm. I write about what I did wrong. Yeah.
And so, like, once you've done that, like, you didn't, you know, there, like, you ceased to have become like a journalistic actor.
Well, I lost my job. I was fired, right. And I was in hiding, and I was afraid. I was terrified.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Of what?
I mean, I write in the book about, you know, I was terrified of the man I did not marry. And I was very worried about people knowing where I was. And can we pause this?
Yeah, we can pause it.
Sorry.
Hey, y'all, at this point in the conversation, we took a beat, gathered ourselves, and got back together for the rest of the convo. So please stick around for Olivia Nuzzi on her new book, American Canto.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
I mean, a lot of my whole, the last year was just, my whole life was destabilized, right? And it also just, there was, I was not in motion for the first time in really since I was like 18, right? Because I'd been working my whole life, and I had been, one of the things about being a political reporter that's so great is that you don't have to justify, the stakes are always apparent, right? Like, you never have to think, like, is what I'm doing important? Like, do I have purpose, right? It's inherent to the task. And that's an enormous burden lifted, I think. And then all of a sudden I'm dealing also just with like a lot of things and people I thought that I knew who were, it turned out, not who I thought that they were. And I could not predict behavior successfully. And I was just scared. Yeah.
I hear you. And I'm sorry. Yeah, because of the stakes is why. No. It's because of the stakes of what you're talking about that I'm like,
yeah.
I'm sticking with this. That's why I
you can ask whatever.
Anyway. Yeah. And so I just like, you said you left, you're in hiding, you're scared. He's a man of huge responsibility right now. Like, if there's another public health crisis, he's in charge. And I'm just trying to like, just ask directly, like, were you scared of him? Like, were you scared of Bobby?
I mean, it's dangerous for a woman to keep any kind of diary, generally speaking. I think history has shown that.
Kennedy history has shown that also.
I was just scared in general, and I felt like I felt very vulnerable in general, and it was very clear to me by the time I made it out here, that no one was going to protect me, right? That that it seemed as though no one really had any boundaries as it related to utilizing me or brutalizing me for their own benefit. And it seems recent events suggest that that's still the case. And so I was scared in general. And it was a strange time, you know.
Yeah.
But I also think I take a, you know, it's your criticism that I don't come out, you know, guns blazing in this book is fair. And, you know, that's totally legitimate that that's your reaction. But writing about this at all is an enormous risk that I've assumed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I realized that there's a certain faction or many factions of people who are just never going to be happy with anything that I do, right? And that's sure. Fine. But I could have just not said anything, right? I could have not told you about my experience here.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There was a Goodfellas element in the book at points where you feel like, did you ever watch the movie Goodfellas? You did. You're Italian.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant I referenced it.
No.
Directly,
like, you know, the helicopters are following him, he thinks, mm-hmm. and then the helicopter ends up following him. There's throughout the book, you're like, yeah. You think the drones are following you. Was a drone following you? That was another thing that never satisfied me.
Hope not. I don't know.
Did you have a Ray Liotta feel to yourself at times? Like, who did you think was manning the drone?
De Niro. I often feel like Ray Liotta in the second half of Goodfellas. And I do root for bad guys in movies.
Okay. A couple other just silly things that are just, you know, that I have to get off my chest before I lose you.
Wait, have you ever read the Nick Pileggi book that Goodfellas is based on?
I should.
It's really good. You should read it. I mean, the script to Goodfellas adheres so strictly to the book that it's astonishing. It's called Wise Guys. It's really good.
I should. Yeah. I never go backwards, kind of. Like, if I've seen a movie, I don't do the book, which is stupid. But that's just, you know.
No, I don't. I typically don't either. Yeah. I love Nick Pileggi, so. Yeah.
Okay. You said you wrote this walking through the, through the hills there in Malibu on your mm-hmm. phone. And mm-hmm. I just have to... You're not pulling some of these. You're doing history facts. You're doing science facts. There's microplastics. There's old quotes.
I write everything on my phone. Yeah.
So you're Googling it while you're writing? Like, are you doing this from memory? How are you handling that?
Well, how do I do it? I'm trying to think. How do I do it?
Like, if you start to reference Plato.
Well, it depends.
Is that all from memory?
I don't think I reference Plato.
Two phones. I've got it right here. I'll start looking for the weirdest reference while you message.
No, but I mean, if I have to come back home and go to a book or go to like my dictionary of etymology or something, that I'm not gonna, I'll just TK it you know, in the moment, or I just write, a lot of times I write, but Tim, a lot of times I write like half sentences while mm-hmm. I'm, you know, and then I, or just half form thoughts. And then I go back to it later, or I, it's important to me to not let ideas flutter away. And so that process of pacing and writing, or hiking and writing, is very good for that, I find, you know. But I know I go back and I, you know, fact check it or edit it later, but also on a phone.
The Dante, you had Dante at Veritas. Obviously, the canto mm-hmm. is a reference to Dante. What mm-hmm. what was that? Yeah. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about Dante.
I just was reading it. I arrived out here, and like it's like I go from the fire of my own life, and then I arrive out here, and the world is literally on fire here, right? And it was hard not to grow pretty attached because of that. I mean, I like broken things. That's no surprise.
And Dante, as I recall, it's been a minute. I think it was probably 1998. Mm-hmm. It made me want to reread it again. Mm-hmm. But I think that you go down into hell and then there's redemption on the other side. Do you mm-hmm. feel like you are we paralleling Dante or just inspired by him?
I wasn't trying to you know, write structurally in the same way. I just I couldn't help but relate to the story of walking into hell. There's a very funny illustration in one of the translations that I have. It's like a chart of hell, and it's like there's an arrow by like the gate to hell that there's a vestibule, and it just says like opportunists.
Who do you imagine is in that vestibule? Everybody that we dealt with over the last 10 years?
It's crowded at the gate.
Yeah. The repetition in the book, is it, are we incanting? Is it incantation, the repetition? Or is that is that just your internal monologue?
The etymology of incantation, I don't know, but I'm going to look it up when we finish here, and I can step into the next room. But no, I mean, canto, it's a division of poetry, and I, you know, it's an elliptical structure, the book, right? There are no chapters or no index. I didn't do acknowledgments because I felt like it would, the kindest thing I could do to anyone who I should thank would be to not put them in this book by name.
It's not that bad, babe. People would have appreciated this, but I hear you. I'm
sending notes privately. I just, you know, I felt like I didn't need to contribute to anyone's harassment, you know. But the elliptical structure, the sort of this idea that I return to a few times of the snake eating its tail, right? And this feeling of the last 10 years being circular, right? And being at the trial with Donald Trump and thinking back to being at the White House or being further uptown at the start of his campaign. I was trying to render an experience for the reader that would feel something of what it felt like to live through all that and to watch it, you know?
Which is a disorienting feeling. You know, we live through that. To that point, I think your best line, that's rude to say best line. One of my favorites was when you talk about how Donald Trump fits in Las Vegas and he fits in all these places, but in the Oval Office, when you'd sit with him, the set of the White House seemed in doubt. Mm-hmm. And then later you talk about how you interviewed Trump after the Butler assassination and how he said to you it didn't feel at all surreal. And I speaking for myself, the Butler assassination and you describing him in the Oval Office, it all makes me feel like we're in a simulation mm-hmm. and that this isn't real at all. And mm-hmm. and I just wonder, you know, if you have a reflection on that, having done navigating the unreality throughout the book and throughout your last decade.
Well, I think it's obvious I've been doing a good job. Right?
Navigating it? No. Feels like it's engulfed you.
But I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Alive. It ends with a raven, the book?
It ends with a hawk, red-tailed hawk.
A hawk? Oh, shit. That was a total flub on my part. The worst bird for me to pick, for me to get that wrong. It ends with the hawk. Yeah. And you weren't sure if the hawk is cutting through the sky, and you weren't sure if it was a reassurance or a warning.
What ends with a drone? Do you want to...
Should I pull it up? I mean, I read it. I finished it a second time last night at 1 a.m. You know, here it is. It's a reminder. There's a hawk. There's a hawk and a drone. There's a hawk and a drone. Okay, there's a hawk and a drone. And the question is whether they're offering you reassurance or whether it's a threat. And I'm wondering if you feel now, after having finished it and having gone through this rollout, whether you feel like maybe it was a threat.
I feel more reassured than ever.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm an optimist, but I also just thoughtful people are quiet. They're not, you know, I find it quite easy to not take personally the digital stoning. Yeah. And often I find value in it. Sometimes people are very funny or have something, you know, useful to say by way of criticism. But it has still been a shock and disturbing to see people engage with this harassment, right? And to not call it that, to not observe it for what it is, just because I am perceived in a lot of ways because of that harassment campaign as having this sort of politics that the people who might support and defend women don't want to defend, right? That's what it feels like. And I think it's...
I agree with that.
Yeah, it's just bullshit.
People that came at you and they're like, oh, this is some political thing because of the Biden article. It's like the Biden article could have been written by anybody with eyes, just not as well as right, just not, like, not as well crafted as you did.
Also, I don't want to steal valor, right? Like Alex Thompson, Annie Lindsay, the Wall Street Journal, Axios, they did real reporting that for which there was nothing but social penalty, right? At a time when it was very difficult. And those reporters deserve credit for that. What I wrote about President Biden came after the debate, right? Like, there was no great revelation. It was about the fact that there had been this conspiracy of silence.
All right. I want to end with something nice. Or I don't know if you'll find it nice. I hope so. The men that you've been talking about, that have been doing the harassment campaign and the politician, nice the secretary. Yeah. We're going to get to it. It's coming. The politician, the fucking secretary that I have nothing but contempt for. All of them, everybody in these books pale, in this book rather, pales in comparison to your dad who is in the book. And I wish that he was still here so that I could have met him and talked to him. And so you would have had him through this process, because I think you write about him so beautifully. And
thanks.
Anyway, I know my mother lost her parents when she was young like you, and it was just so tough for her, and they were also great. And her dad was great. And it reminded me of that, how tough that was for her, but how she kind of held him with her, you know, in ways that strengthened her. And I hope that you had that.
Thank you. No, I mean, I write in the book that it was the first time I was happy that he wasn't here was during all that. Since like, well, at least I don't have to, he doesn't have to see this, you know?
Probably wrong though.
But yeah, I don't know. I'd rather have had him for a short time than someone else for a long time, you know?
All right. I appreciate you, girl. Hang in there. Tell Monica hi for me. All right.
So I'm going to add to my list of signs that your book rollout has gone awry. Tim Miller says, I appreciate you, girl. Hang in there.
We're just going to leave it there. That was a podcast. You didn't tell me to fuck off. I told you a good podcast would be if you told me to fuck off. So
I can't say that to you.
All right.
Every word casts a spell, Tim. Words are powerful.
That is true. We'll leave it with that. It's American Canto. Go get it. Go get it. It's American Canto. Don't listen to the haters. Yeah. Everybody else, we'll see you later today with another edition of the Bulwark Podcast. Oh, no. Tomorrow. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm lost. It's been a week. We'll see you tomorrow with another edition of the Bulwark Podcast. Peace.
Massacre. Nausicaa, I wanna know you.
Tell me how it feels.
Disappear.
Was it from the side?
You can't smoke here. Feeling for a pipe to go down.
Love will be revealed.
Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.